Well, I wonder how many of you have got a favourite place where you go to pray. Maybe a nice comfy chair in your bedroom or in a study, or there could be a spot in the country that you go to on a warm day. Or it might even be you love to come in here to All Souls and take perhaps a slightly less comfy chair just in case you're in danger of falling asleep. But one place I can guarantee you wouldn't choose is inside a big fish. Clearly getting inside one and then remaining alive to pray will actually be quite a challenge. But if you were to pick a place for a dramatic, once-in-a-lifetime prayerful encounter with God, I'm absolutely certain you'd pick somewhere different from this. Nowhere, surely, could be worse than that. So before we go any further, I probably need to deal with a question that's bound to be in your mind at the moment, and that is, did this really happen? Can a giant fish come along, pick up a half-dead human being, swallow him whole, and then deposit him alive on dry land 2 or 3 days later? Surely, in real life, things like this can't happen, can they? Well, apparently they can. All you have to do is Google something like, can someone live in a whale for 3 days? And amazingly, you'll get all sorts of arguments and scientific evidence to look at if you're really interested. So you can check that out on the internet if you want, but I'm not going to go there today. But what I am going to say is there's two small points that I want to mention to start with. Firstly, nowhere does the Bible say that it was a whale that swallowed him. Not that that makes a huge amount of difference, mind you, but it is an interesting misconception that's been handed down. May have been a whale, may not have been. But then secondly, and probably more importantly, nowhere does the Bible say that Jonah was actually alive for all that time. It does say he was alive long enough to pray, but it merely says he was in the belly for 3 days and three nights. He could actually have been alive for a very short while and then died. In actual fact, I'd never really thought about this before, but the more I have thought about it, I think the more convincing that explanation could be. But the whole point is that if you believe that, you have to believe that someone could come back to life again. And that really brings me on to the key point here, that you see, if you can't believe that Jonah could be swallowed by a big fish and then vomited alive to dry land a few days later, how can you ever believe that a man can die on a cross, be buried, and then come back to life again? Mark mentioned Matthew chapter 12. He read verse 39 last week when he looked at chapter 1. I'm going to have another look at it again just very briefly. I'll read it to you, no need to turn to it. I'll read from verse 38 to 40 just to give you the context. Then some of the Pharisees and teachers of the law said to him, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." He answered, this is Jesus, by the way, "A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but none will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." You see, the point is, if you can't believe in Jonah, you'll never believe in Jesus. Because Jonah's 3 days and nights inside the fish is the clearest, most blatantly obvious demonstration of the miracle that underpins the whole of the Christian faith, the death and resurrection of Jesus. So do these things normally happen? No. But if God's God, he can make what doesn't normally happen, happen. And that's why it's a miracle. And he performs a miracle only when he chooses to do so, and as a sign for us to sit up and take notice and say, look, this is important. So you see, it's impossible to be a Christian unless you believe miracles can happen. So I'm perfectly happy that this account is factually correct. I've got no worries about it at all. But having said all that, I have been a Christian for 30 years now, and I didn't become a Christian by believing the story of Jonah. So if you are struggling to get to grips with the truth of this, please don't get too hung up about it for now, as I want you to stay with me, as there's some other pretty basic issues we need to look at as we look at chapter 2. Because we could just stop here and say, isn't this just an amazing example of God's power? He's so in control of things that he commands a fish to swallow up a disobedient prophet and vomit him back to life again as an amazing foretaste of what he's going to do about 800 years later with his son. And of course, that's absolutely true. But as we look at chapter 2, we see there's even more there to grab us. Because we don't just get a foretaste of Jesus' death and resurrection as we look at this passage. We also see a picture of what that death and resurrection means for Jonah, and also what it means for us as individuals. So, what do we see? Well, I want to split this under a couple of headings. It's a psalm of thanksgiving, so in some ways it's meant to be soaked in rather than dissected. but I hope splitting it down this way is a helpful approach. So the first heading, Jonah sees his sin and tastes death and separation from God as a result. Now, you've got to go back to chapter 1 to get the full picture here. But the fact that Jonah's very aware of his sin is pretty obvious. The clearest reference is probably verse 12, where Jonah says to the sailors, "Pick me up and throw me into the sea," he replied, "and it will become calm. I know that this is my fault, that this great storm has come upon you." So, although interestingly, actually, the sailors don't seem to see it this way, because in verse 14, the sailors even describe Jonah as an innocent man, which, of course, gives us yet one more echo of Jesus. But the fact is that from Jonah's viewpoint, he was a sinner, and he knew it. He'd chosen to do what he wanted and not what God wanted. He directly disobeyed God, and he knew he deserved to die. And as we head into chapter 2, he was in distress. So verse 1 there, "You've got in my distress, I call to the Lord." Going down to verse 5 and 6, "He stared death in the face. So the engulfing waters threatened me, the deep surrounded me. Seaweed was wrapped around my head. To the roots of the mountains I sank down, the earth beneath barred me in forever." And he experienced real separation from God. So verse 4, go back to verse 4. "I said, I have been banished from your sight." So it's a terrifying experience for him. He was face to face with death, but worse still was the fact that he was facing it banished from the presence of God. And of course, we're meant to look at this and say, as it is for Jonah, so it is for us. We too choose to do things our way and not God's way. We too will face death at some time. And we too bear the prospect of facing it banished from the presence of God. So this is a stark warning for us. We, like Jonah, should be terrified. And the question, of course, is, do we recognize this? Do we see that we're in danger? Because all of us want to do things our way, not God's way. So do we see that every one of us risks being banished from God's presence forever? It should be the most basic message for a church congregation to hear. You're not likely to hear it from the world outside, of course, because none of us really want to face up to it. But the sad fact is, you may well not hear it in a church now either. In the late 1980s, I was helping out at a course in my first ever church in Bristol. It was long before the days of Christianity Explored, and probably even Alpha come to that. So we were doing a homegrown basic introduction to Christianity course, which I think was called Basics, actually, and the vicar was leading it. And one evening he said how critical it was to realize that all of us were sinners. And there was one guy there who started to protest. I think he'd been brought along by his wife or his girlfriend, and she was sitting there looking a little bit embarrassed as he tried arguing his case. And it went on for a while until in the end the vicar sort of cut him off and said, "Well, if you never understand you're a sinner, you'll never understand Christianity." That was the end of that, basically. The conversation moved on to something else and he never came back next week. I don't know what happened to him. Now, I'm not saying that was necessarily the right way to handle it, because people become aware of their sin in very different ways, and they may well need a bit of a shock or a clear encounter with God before they're prepared to look at things more deeply. But the bottom line is that the vicar was right. You will never grasp Christianity. You'll never really grasp what Jesus' death and resurrection is all about until you've grasped the fact that your sin separates you from God. I realise our church backgrounds are all different, and some of you may well have been scarred by churches where the message of sin was abundantly clear, but the freedom that comes through Christ was never mentioned. So I know we hear things differently depending on where we're coming from, but the point is that if we don't understand sin and the pervasive impact it has, we'll never understand ourselves, we'll never understand our world, and we'll never grasp the full glory of what Jesus Christ has done for us. And that brings me on to my second heading. We look at Jonah. So he sees his sin and experiences separation from God, and then he cries for help and experiences salvation from God. So, for example, we've got verse 2, "In my distress, I called to the Lord and he answered me. From deep in the realm of the dead, I called for help and you listened to my cry." And then going down to verse 7 all the way through to the end of verse 10, "When my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to your holy temple, to you, to your holy temple. Those who cling to worthless idols turn away from God's love for them. but I with shouts of grateful praise will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will make good. I will say, salvation comes from the Lord. And the Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. So we have the most wonderful example of God's salvation here. There was Jonah, stuck at the bottom of the sea, head covered in seaweed, no hope in sight. In desperation, he cries out, and a miracle happens. He experiences physical salvation. The fish eventually vomits him onto dry land. But more importantly than that, he experiences spiritual salvation. Verse 9 again, but I, with shouts of grateful praise, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will make good. I will say salvation comes from the Lord. Now, we'll see in the next couple of weeks that Jonah's far from the finished article, so a work in progress is probably the best label that we can give him. But the point is that he's turned around. He's starting to move in the right direction in the way he lives his life, and the key to this is that his relationship with God has been restored. And it happens all because he cried for help. Simple as that. And of course, the cynic may turn around and say, well, what's so special about that? Yet wouldn't anyone do the same in his situation, stuck at the bottom of the sea with seaweed around his head? Well, the answer to that is actually no, not necessarily. Just have a look again at verse 8. We've got there, those who cling to worthless idols turn away from God's love for them. And then contrast that with the start of verse 9. But I, with shouts of grateful praise, will sacrifice to you. So the truth is that not everyone would have done the same thing in Jonah's situation. There is an alternative. You can cling to worthless idols instead. What are idols? Well, in the simplest sense, they're physical images of a man-made God. But in the broader sense, they can be anything that we worship. So these are the things that drive us deep down. The things that distract us from following the true God. Empty nothings is apparently the literal Hebrew translation of worthless idols. So, of course, this is a very real danger for all of us, because we've all got things that are important to us, and these may well be very good things in themselves. But if they become the things that drive us, and as a result they get in the way of following God with all our heart, mind, and soul, then they too can become a worthless idol, an empty nothing. What could these idols be? Well, there's the obvious ones: career, money, relationships, all perfectly good God-given things. But they become a problem and a snare when they become the driving force in our lives. So, you know, we can probably see that quite easily. But what was Jonah's idol? What was driving him as he headed off to Tarshish? Well, you can't see that quite so easily. But as we head on to chapter 3 and 4, it becomes pretty plain that Jonah hates the Ninevites. And it seems as though his rightful desire to uphold God's honor and protect his people, the Israelites, from their enemy has turned into a personal mission of hate and destruction. So, of course, when the word of the Lord says, go to Nineveh and preach, that's the last thing Jonah wants to hear. Because he knows that the one true God pursues everyone with his love and compassion, as Mark told us last week. And if he's been called to Nineveh, he knows that there's more than just a slight chance that the Ninevites will turn away from their own worthless idols and repent. And that's bad news for him. And what's happening is there's a genuine battle going on in his heart, and it's actually been going on from the moment that he got the call. Is he going to go to Nineveh, or isn't he? Did he know that if he disobeyed God, he'd be risking death? Well, who knows? If you look on to chapter 4, it looks to me like he probably did. But as he stood on the deck with those sailors in the storm, he surely must have done. And the point is that verses 8 and 9 are the pivotal point for him. He's in the pit. What's he going to cling to? Is it going to be the God who's called him? Or is he still going to stubbornly refuse to go to Nineveh? You see, the point's very clear. When God exposes your sin to you, you've got two choices. You can say, no, thank you. I'll ignore the warning and keep on doing things my way. Or you can cry for help and experience salvation. Because the amazing truth is that the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the death and resurrection that Jonah prefigured, allows the sin that banishes us from God's presence to be washed away and our relationship with God to be restored. Now, of course, this is true for someone who's never heard this message before. So if you just walked in off the street and you've never been in a church in your life before today, then this is indeed for you. But actually, the dominant message in the story of Jonah is for those who have heard it all before. Because Jonah knew who God was. He'd known him for a long while. And what's more, God knew who Jonah was. He knew all about what was in his heart, and he didn't want him to stay that way. So he exposed the particular worthless idol that he was clinging to, and when Jonah eventually cried for help, he saved him. Still very much as a work in progress, but at least now heading in the right direction. So I don't know where you're at today. It may be you've known of God for a long while, but never actually really allowed him into your life. Alternatively, you may once have had what felt like a really strong relationship with him, but now it seems to have faded a bit, and other things may have got in the way, and now you might feel in a bit of a mess. Or it may be your life's not in a mess. Things could actually be going rather well, but you know in your heart of hearts that you're not heading the right way, and sooner or later, you're afraid that you too may find yourself banished from God's sight. Well, wherever you are, the message of Jonah is very clear. If he can come back to God from the bottom of the sea with seaweed round his head, then you can come back to God from wherever you are. There is always a way back. All you have to do is stop clinging to your worthless idols and cry for help, like Jonah did.